Hello there, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. My name's William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or follow via the Facebook page, or subscribe at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you're a fan of this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, making a small or large monetary donation on a per episode basis. Find details through all the Turkey Book Talk pages of that. You can also help in another way by rating it or reviewing it on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. That makes it easier for other interested people to find the podcast if they don't already know about it. Also, let me follow up my lame appeal from the last episode for the Facebook page. So please do like that page. The more people who like it, the more other people who don't know about it can see it on Facebook. But now let's get on with the show. And in this episode, I speak to Kaya Genç, who's the author of a new book called Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey, which is another one published by the great IB Taurus. Kaya is a scarily prolific writer of articles and books on contemporary Turkey and Istanbul, and this is actually his second appearance on the Turkey Book Talk podcast. I spoke to him earlier this year about a new anthology of writing on Istanbul that he edited, so I'll post a link to that with the notes to this show on the WordPress page, etc. Under the Shadow paints a rich portrait of today's Turkey by profiling young Turks from across the political spectrum. I started by asking Kaya Genç what he wanted to achieve with this latest book.
I didn't start with a thesis. I wanted to listen to people and hear their stories and the way they tell their stories, the way they articulate their views. And so I wanted to be like a fly on the wall and just, you know, hear them out, because I'm seeing all these intelligent people passionate about their political beliefs, and they're mostly disagreeing with each other, but they all make some legitimate points. So the difficult thing for me was to pick who to speak to, because the political parties are there. You can, you know, pick one people from each party, or you can pick one people from the left, from the right, but then what is left and right in Turkey? You know, these are all not very clear-cut things. So I had to find young people, because I wanted this book to be about young people, and I wanted to find articulate people who were willing to communicate their views to me. So that was one of the beginning points, but then I had to find people from different spheres of life. I wanted to find people from the cultural world, from the political world. I wanted to find business people, so that there'd be like lots of different voices that would somehow create a illusion of the Turkish youth speaking throughout the book. So of course it's very, in a way, curated and structured, but of course the writer's role is to make it seem as if it's a natural thing. It's as if we're just listening to the Turkish streets. So I'm aware of that. It's very constructed in a way. But then I wanted it to be a good construction.
And you started writing, I think, after the anti-government Gezi Park protests in 2013. You finished just before the military coup attempt earlier this year, I think. So obviously that throws up this question of how things move so fast in Turkey, where anything you write can end up out of date. Did you feel that was a challenge as you were writing the book? Did you find yourself like updating parts of it as you went along?
Yeah, when I was writing the book, Gezi Park was closed to all kind of protests. If you went there with five people, and if you, you know, just started telling something out loud, you'd get into trouble by the police. It was very heavily guarded, and all the political sphere was like, you know, there was some stifling of people's voices. So people were like whispering to me their stories, both from the left and from the right. And then there was the 2015 elections. And so, for example, one of my interviewees was running for election from the AK Party. And then there were others who were supporters of Surre Süreyya Önder, another MP. So politics was everywhere. There was election season after Gezi, and people were seeing these dreams and then seeing these dreams smashed to pieces. And after finishing the book and after I started working on the proofs, and I was actually responsible for doing the index of the book. And so when I was doing the index, the military coup happened on the night of July 15th. So I suddenly found myself in a very different place. I was like, will I ever be able to publish the book? And then, of course, after the coup, like Gezi Park, where I live close by, was suddenly open to all kind of demonstrations and political views. And there was this sudden reversal of the political structure here. So it felt like everyone could go there and do whatever they liked. The police just went invisible. I was like, I was there to report, and there were all plainclothes policemen around. And suddenly it was like people, the police was texting people to come to the squares and to demonstrate. So it was a remarkable change in the course of Turkish politics.
And the book includes voices from across the spectrum. Each chapter's got a set of kind of pen portraits of different voices of young people. And there aren't many interjections from yourself. You just let them speak for themselves, talking about what they think, how they respond to things. Was that like a deliberate attempt on your part to just kind of leave the floor to these people who are profiled in the book?
I have both the scholarly temperament and the journalistic temperament, and I wanted to bring those things together. I wanted to hear the voices of those young people who are like working for media, doing films, running publishing houses. But then I didn't really think that it didn't matter what I thought about their views. It's like, what mattered was that their very beautifully articulated views had to be represented in a truthful way. And what I could do as a scholar come journalist would be to point to historical similarities, because I'm an avid reader of late 19th century Ottoman literature, and I suddenly started seeing some reflections of these young people in late Ottoman times, and the whole young Turk spirit was there to be found in very different incarnations. And I thought that my authorial voice in the book wouldn't be just say like, oh, look at this conservative people, he's saying this, but it's not true. Or look at this progressive, how, you know, dreamful he is. Rather than doing that, let's put them, their views into historical perspective, and let's show how they're similar to, let's say, Namık Kemal or Tevfik Fikret's views, and how they're like all these echoes coming from history that we can identify in their voices. I think that would be a more subtle and elegant way of speaking as a writer. And then I suddenly found myself doing that in different chapters. So that was a tracing their voices in history and putting it in a historical context. That's what I thought my authorial role was here.
Also, I mean, you say there's a kind of deliberate attempt in the book to really take seriously the kind of voice of the other Turkey, you could say, the government-supporting majority that's rarely heard by English readers these days. Was that a deliberate attempt on your part to get their voices across?
Yeah, because lots of the conservative people I spoke to, they're coming from what people used to call liberal tradition in Turkey, but the Turkish liberalism was something that its meaning is very ambiguous throughout 2000s. Like, if you supported the locking up of secularists, you were called a liberal. And that was, I think, very strange. And when you approach these people, they're like supporting the governing party and also calling them liberals, call themselves liberals. And when you looked at them, it was like, because the governing party was pro-EU and they had this Europeanizing agenda, they somehow felt like, I'm not really articulating myself here. You know, am I really a conservative here by supporting this party? But in the last years, in the past maybe 3 years, I think the conservatives found their voice, really. And it's a voice that the liberals don't like at all. But I think that's the source of their voice comes from this young Ottoman movement, which is a combination of Islamism and Ottomanism and constitutionalism. And during the first decade of the AK Party, that voice was not articulated in the way that it is now. And so it's like conservatives found their voice, and it's a voice that's a bit violent and it's uneasy to listen to, but they're finding their voice. And of course, the Young Turk voice also was stifled during the first decade of this century. And now they are like, again, finding some passion in their voice again. So I think the last few years showed us that, you know, we are having like this post-liberal moment in Turkey, because liberalism was like perceived as something behind which one could hide himself or herself. It was a way of not articulating your views, not putting them out there. So I think the last few years has changed that, all of that.
How was the fact that the book was written in English and the audience was going to be an English reading audience? How did that change the way that you went about writing it? What do you think would have been different if you were writing for a Turkish readership?
I think I got used to writing for an English, for a British and American audience. First of all, it has to be very lucid, it has to be a bit devoid of some stylistic plays, or it has to be very plain and understandable. It has to be like a bit like Hemingway, and like it has. You're not doing it for stylistic reasons. You want it to be very clear and open, and you want people to see a reflection of the city, of this culture in it. And those people have not seen this city before in their lives, so it's a big responsibility. And so you have to be reflective of very different aspects of this city, of this culture. So it's a big responsibility, and you can misuse it very easily, because perhaps someone in Westminster will be reading this book and will maybe never come to Istanbul. So your writing will be her truth. But then again, I used to write for Turkish book reviews and magazines for a long time. And here, everyone knows what you're talking about. And the trick here is to articulate yourself in a different way and to differentiate your voice from others through different literary means. So you may have this view and this education, but then the way you express yourself and your subject has to be in such a way that people will be like, ah, that's Kaya Genç's voice. But when I write in English, it is a different, it's a different game. And I found it very liberating and also educating to write in English, because the editors are very much engaged in the act of writing and in the act of suggesting things and to smooth your prose and to make it more far-reaching. So I think writing in Turkish, that's something we lack a bit. I worked as an editor for Turkish Sunday papers and book reviews, and people don't like, I mean, writers don't like editors to change what they write. It's like what you're trying to protect what you write, and you're like, I'm just gonna put it out to readers and they'll just see my style. But the editor that doesn't really play that role of smoothing your prose. But in English, you get used to what editors pay attention to and how they're trying to make your writing more accessible. And after a while, you start to write in a more accessible way. And that's no longer a problem for you, because in Turkish literature, you know, if a prose is too accessible, if it's too open, too lucid, too clear, maybe that's like a bad thing. You know, we want to be less understandable. We want to be more difficult. So in English, it's you have to write in the opposite way. So that was quite a challenge for me.
Yeah, that's so true. The kind of lack of editing I've noticed as well. Here, people don't like it. And it's kind of obvious as well, because, you know, so much stuff is put out that's clearly not edited properly. But this book is really beautifully written, I think, and it has, you know, it's very lucid. So I think you've done a good job on that front. You paint this kind of picture of Turkey that's defined by these social groups, various social groups. And in a way, like, understanding Turkey is understanding those fissures that have these historical roots. That's a way to understand what's happening in the country. I wonder if that doesn't maybe neglect some of the more, some of the other questions of, like, raw power and how it's wielded, because that so often defines what happens in Turkey. This isn't the work of, like, political science, but did you want to kind of focus more consciously on this social aspect?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the what you call the raw power and its machinations and how it's produced and disseminated in society and how raw power continues to exist and how it defends itself and how it changes people's lives. It's like political discourse, speech writing, the lofty concepts that we hear in political speeches. That's something that I'm working on at the moment for another book. And it's the sphere of power, political power. And it's, I think, it's a different world. And it deserves a separate work, I thought. In a book where I wanted to hear people's voices, people articulating themselves, I didn't want to put the political discourse and ideology, press those things on them and somehow give a certain shape to their articulations through my understanding of political power. So I very consciously saved that material for another book and chose in the limited space of the book to hear people's stories. You know, I wanted to listen to how they felt discriminated in high school, or what they felt in the first year of university. I didn't want to impose Turkish political history or this republicanism and constitutionalism on these things. I wanted to point to historical echoes, but the current political discourses and their production, I wanted these are things I want to focus in another book. I wanted this book to be all about young people and their stories.
And you describe in the book, I think in the introduction, how you were finishing the book off as the coup attempt happened. What do you think about, what do you make about the current situation? Everything's very much in flux. There's some very pessimistic people around. What do you think? I mean, how do you see things developing from now in the coming months ahead?
Well, people say it's the last nail on the coffin for Turkish democracy, but people have been saying that for the past 3 years, and I don't know if that feeling is really got to do with reality or how the observers look at reality. There is this certain pessimism of the observers that look at Turkey and find it very depressing, and it's like, let's leave Turkey. Turkey is unlivable. You know, let's go to US. It's gonna be great there. But you look at the world situation. You look at France. You look at Britain and the US. I mean, the politics are changing everywhere, and the politics are definitely changing here. But people don't want to spend time understanding what's really going on here. You know, like people have been trying to understand what's going on in England with Brexit. That's something you cannot escape from. There's the reality. There's the electorate, and people are changing the course of politics. And in Turkey as well, we have to pay more attention to why people are more intent on things like independence and sovereignty right now. Why does the political discourse really work, is really successful when politicians talk about these things, sovereignty and independence? How does it strike a chord with people? We don't try to understand it. We have to pay more attention to it, because otherwise people will, you know, keep on articulating these views and will continue not to understand it. So in Turkey, the current situation is very much about these concepts: sovereignty, independence, and it's a mood that we find with the Young Turks that I describe in the book, and we have to see these historic similarities and try to understand how people get these notions from their grandparents, and it's like it runs through the family. They hear these stories of fighting against foreigners and, you know, trying to keep their country independent from foreigners. You know, it's like family heritage for many people, and politicians are using these personal stories, these personal codes, and transforming them into political machines. And some politicians are more successful at doing that, and we have to understand how they achieved that. We should have to comprehend how that mood is created and recreated and instrumentalized, and that's a responsibility for writers and intellectuals. You know, you cannot just be pessimistic and escape from the country. You have to pay attention to what people say, to what people articulate, and how politicians make use of that.
That was Kaya Genç, my review of the book we were discussing, Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey, is forthcoming in the Times Literary Supplement and later in the Hürriyet Daily News in edited form, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Don't forget, subscribe to Turkey Book Talk if you haven't already via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. You can also like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and also rate or review the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Email me with feedback and or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. That's John with a H. Finally, you can support the podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Bayarslan, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode, thank you very much for listening.